The Book as Art.
And so I said, give me a minute. And I walked away, came back in a minute, and I said, how about this? I do a project called The Book About Death, which is an unbound book. And then I said, I'll invite 1,000 artists to send 500 postcards, and I'll put them out on the floor, and people will come and compile their own book. And he looked at me, and he said, do it!
That's artist and writer Matthew Rose. We talk with him today about his unbound book of artist postcards, A Book About Death, which I first saw in a Soho gallery in Manhattan.
I realized then that this wasn't an academic exercise, that this was life and death, and life and death over a vast and staggering scale, which I could scarcely get my mind around, but also life and death on a very, very small scale, and that small scale was sitting on my thigh.
And that's environmental writer George Monbiot. We air part of a 2007 interview with him to give us some food for thought after the UN climate talks in Copenhagen. We also air a snippet of an interview with environmental writer Bill McKibben. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Riana. The Soho district in Manhattan is known today as one of the city's toniest neighborhoods, a place where you can drop a cool $2 or $3 million to buy a loft. But before the mid-1960s, it was a decaying industrial district with lofts emptied out by the exodus of manufacturing to the south and eventually overseas. Soho's renaissance was due to one man, the artist George Matsunis. He began buying up the old lofts in the 1960s to create artist cooperatives, especially for friends of his like videographer Nam June Paik and filmmaker Jonas Mekas. Matsunis was a leader of the avant-garde movement Fluxus, which, in addition to Paik and Mekas, included musician John Cage and artist Yoko Ono. Matsunis called the artist lofts Flux Boxes. My mother, a mixed-media modern dancer and choreographer, bought a loft from George Matsunis. One of her fellow artist co-op members was Emily Harvey, muse and art dealer to the Fluxus movement. Harvey, who died in 2004, set up a foundation which still has a gallery in the building. In October, when I was staying at my mother's loft, I happened to pass by the gallery's open door and heard some commotion inside. I popped in and found a singular exhibition being mounted. It was an unbound book of postcards sent in by nearly 500 artists from around the world, every one of them on the theme of death. The cards, each having 500 copies, were stacked in piles on the floor with an array of them on the wall, and they were all free for the taking. It's called A Book About Death, and you can see it and download the images on the web. We've got links at writersvoice.net. A couple of weeks later, I called up the exhibition's curator, artist and writer Matthew Rose. I started out by asking him how and why he had conceived of this project.
The project actually started in name with the artist Ray Johnson, who died in 1995. Ray Johnson, if you don't know, was the founder of male art. He's known as the father of male art. What Ray did, he had made a number of collages, and I suppose he thought it would be interesting to put them in envelopes and send them to people and trigger some kind of correspondence between himself and the individual. And I know that he had been mailing things that were artfully done and letters that had illustrations on them since he was a teenager in Detroit. And as he got older, went to Black Mountain College. He met a number of different people working in the avant-garde, and he met many other people involved in various ways of making art, disseminating art, thinking about art. Rauschenberg was down there, I believe. Buckminster Fuller was there. And I think in 1948 he moved up to New York and lived downtown. And he began making these very dense geometric collages. And then at one point, I'm not the expert on Ray Johnson's history, but at some point he began making different kinds of collages as sort of in a pre-pop mode with pictures of Elvis, but also commercial logos. I mean, Lucky Strike logos and Camel cigarette packages. And he began being very attracted by the mail system. I know that one day, I can't say when, but this is probably in the film about him called How to Draw a Bunny, directed by John Walter, he spent the day walking to every single mailbox in Brooklyn. So clearly there was a connection between what he was doing and the mail system, and I suppose he was very, very attracted by this idea of putting an art object into an envelope and moving it into the world. What is famously said about Ray is that Ray Johnson is to the letter what Joseph Cornell was to the box. So Ray's use of the mail kind of inspired a lot of people and created a kind of a network. I mean, a lot of people just received his work, didn't quite know what to make of it. And then it just expanded. And some years later, I think it was Ed Plunkett, suggested he call his network the New York Correspondence School, and so there it was born. So I was speaking with Christian Zatrek, who is the director of the Emily Harvey Foundation, and I wanted to do a project in the foundation space. Emily Harvey was an art dealer specializing in Fluxus artists, and she dealt with the remaining Fluxus artists. And he said, sure, that's good. What do you have in mind? And then he added the note, you know, I'm not interested in having artists hang their work up in the space and waiting for people to come buy it. And this was in January of this year in New York. And so I said, give me a minute. And I walked away, came back in a minute, and I said, how about this? I said, I do a project called A Book About Death, which is inspired by a mail art piece project by Ray Johnson, which is an unbound book, just photocopy pages of drawings he made. And then I said, I'll invite 1,000 artists to send 500 postcards, and I'll put them out on the floor, and people will come and compile their own book. And he looked at me, and he said, do it! And I said, okay. And then by March, I had the site up and all the submission guidelines, and then it was launched. And they just started slowly coming in, and people mailed the 500 postcards to the gallery, and it just grew and grew and grew and grew and grew. And in the end, we had about 500 boxes of cards, which is about 250,000 postcards.
And we will be putting up links to some of those images. I went to this exhibit. My mother owns a loft in the artist cooperative that actually was started, one of the loft cooperatives started by George Matunas, who was the founder of Fluxus. Bring us back a little bit. Just tell us briefly, what was Fluxus? What is Fluxus?
Well, people will argue about this forever, but most people agree that Fluxus was George Matunas. George Matunas was an artist who reinvigorated the Soho area, buying lofts and securing lofts for artists, calling them flux boxes, where they could live and work. And this is a time, I guess, in the early 60s. Fluxus is kind of it's called a lot of different things. Dick Higgins has a whole definition of what it is. Intermedia, it basically uses pretty much anything, but you can have things as simple as a score, which is three sentences saying what you have to do. Like, number one, wake up in the morning. Number two, brush your teeth. Number three, brush your teeth again. I mean, things like that. It's very connected to music, very connected to objects. George Matunas was an amazing designer. And his stamp on all of these Fluxus artists' works, because they would come into him, I'm not sure exactly how that would work, but he would design a package for them, and then they would be sold for, you know, $1 or $5. Very inexpensive, things like Suicide Kits. Scores. Yeah, they're amazing stuff. You know, little plastic box, and George Matunas designed the type on the package, and maybe there was an edition of 50. And they each had a razor blade or a little tiny piece of string, a match, or a button, sometimes mysterious. And they would be in some kind of store. I mean, this is well before the internet, and people who saw them, they would buy them. I'm not exactly sure how they would distribute it, but there was sort of a retail aspect to it. But Fluxus involved a lot of people, including Ben Vautier in France, and Joseph Beuys was Fluxus.
And Yoko Ono. And
Yoko Ono was Fluxus. There are just so many. Dick Higgins and Eric Anderson. I mean, if you go simply Google Fluxus, you will find it has to be, you know, 20, 30 artists. Nam June Paik. Ray Johnson was not Fluxus, and Ray said to me, because he was a neighbor of mine on Long Island, he said, "Oh, I'm not Fluxus, I'm Buxus."
And wasn't that even kind of the idea in a way? I mean, the idea of Fluxus, as I understand it, was to, well, there are many ideas, but one of them was to take away the idea of the art world as something separate from real life, and take out the kind of the highfalutin, elitist, commercialized aspect of art.
Absolutely. I mean, famously, it was said to consist of gewgaws and things, gewgaws and games, things like that, which I agree, it's a sort of sapped the market value out of it. Ironically, a lot of those $1 boxes and pieces of papers and Fluxus involved a number of inexpensive objects that were distributed in a variety of ways. And you are correct, it was not conceived in order to replace high-end art objects and be shown in high-end galleries. It was a kind of a small army assembled by Chairman George that went out into the world, and I agree, tried to kind of upset in some ways that art world balance. And I think they succeeded in a lot of ways because the ideas contained in Fluxus have spread, and so you can continually see a slew of exhibitions by artists who use music or Fluxus-inspired ideas. I'm thinking mostly of Christian Marclay, who is always using music in wonderful ways that are extremely clever and beautiful and poetic that I think would clearly have impressed all the Fluxus artists. And certainly he's a hero to lots of different people. But he wasn't Fluxus. He didn't have that rubber stamp that said Fluxus.
Could you say his name again?
Yeah, that's Christian Marclay.
So your work, the book about death, I was reading a little bit about Fluxus, and I saw that at one point George Matunas said that Fluxus was epitomized by the work of George Brecht, particularly his word event, Exit, and that this artwork consists solely of a card on which is printed the words word event and then the word exit. And there are many beautiful, beautiful cards in the book about death, but there are also some that are as simple as that, that just have some writing on them.
Laurent Marichal did a wonderful piece, which is just a blank piece of paper with little tabs cut on the bottom. Much that you see stuck to mailboxes all over the world for people selling services like laundry, babysitting, help with your math homework, and you pull the tab, and on the tab is a phone number, and the whole simply rubber stamped a book about death on it, and everything else is completely blank. And it's a gorgeous little piece, and when we install the show, we put one sample of each card on the wall. And the Hall's piece we put on the right-hand side, and during the opening, which was an amazing crush of people, 300 people in the space at any one time, and an hour-long wait, 500, 600 people outside, all the way up Broadway trying to get in. People were all over the wall, obviously, and they saw this piece, and somebody just pulled a tab off sort of to activate the piece, and that, to me, was kind of a beautiful thing.
And why?
Because it invited interaction, and somebody interacted with it. They didn't destroy it. They didn't take it down. They interacted with it. It's just very, very, very poetic. But all of these pieces, all of the works, and about 500 of them, were conscientiously made and produced for this exhibition. And each one has something very special about it. The content could be, you know, personal, whether it's a painting or something that was handmade. One artist, Gary Bibb, produced 500 pieces by hand, drawings, and he numbered them and signed them and dated them and wrote a book about death by hand on each one of them. Another artist, Mikkel Tersen, did a card and then she sewed on a red thread. Very beautiful, time-consuming work, but very well made and clearly well received by people.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with artist, critic, and writer Matthew Rose about the art installation he organized, A Book About Death. It's a collection of 500 limited edition postcards on the theme of death, each one created by an artist for the exhibition. One of the contributors was Yoko Ono. Matthew Rose tells us about the card.
Yoko's piece is a photograph of a work installation she did of sculptures of wooden coffins arranged in a grid on a floor, photographed by a collaborator of hers. And the wooden coffins have the top open, well, just the head part open, and out of them grow these trees. And so there's sort of a grove of trees. And on the back, she hand rubber stamped A Book About Death. That was the one requirement of all the works coming in, that the phrase A Book About Death in any language, in any type style, be present on the card so that it would be connected to the exhibition.
You know, so much on the internet is free content. You know, we like to say these days content is free, and one can go to the website of the Book About Death and download images. But you also allowed people to just come in and assemble, basically go away with the art for free as well. Talk about that, and talk about why you wanted to do it that way. What does that say about this kind of art, about this exhibition?
Well, the concept of the exhibition, beyond the name and the artwork submitted, there are many, many levels to the whole thing. I thought, in a Duchampian way, the exhibition in a box, we could create something that is outside the market. It's in an art gallery in New York that has nothing to do with money, and people would be able to go in and actually see the exhibition and leave with the exhibition, the entire exhibition, have a complete collection of this show. And I just thought that was really interesting, and I don't know any other place where you can do that. I mean, you can't go into the Met and leave with the exhibition. You'd have to buy a book. But mm-hmm. Here you actually leave with a limited edition book, which is the exhibition. The artist or the curator or the friend of the gallery or the visitor from anywhere, there were no requirements other than that they get on their hands and knees and go through all the 500, I think it's 487 boxes, and take one of each, put it in a bag, and walk out. And then they can go and do what they want with it, maybe re-exhibit it or show it or put it in their home in some way. But I wanted to make it free. I didn't want to put a price on it. I didn't want to profit from it. This Emily Harvey Foundation Gallery is a non-profit space, and I wanted to essentially distribute these artists' works throughout the world, and that was the idea. So I thought that was an interesting way of doing it, but gathering them up, and I think you yourself did that, correct?
I did. It was a laborious but very worthwhile process.
And you ached a little bit after, no?
Just a bit.
Right. So all the works were arranged in their original boxes on the floor in about five or six long lines. It kind of looked like a Donald Judd tombstone-type arrangement. There are installation shots on the blog. And it takes about 25 minutes, 30 minutes, would you say?
Yeah, and also it makes you have a very physical and intimate kind of interaction with the art, and that would take 25 or 30 minutes if you're just gathering up the postcards. If you're actually taking the time to look through them, it could take a whole day.
Yeah, But I thought that that was a very important aspect of the show, a physical aspect. I mean, we clearly wanted to give it away, but we didn't want to put them in, you know, designer bags and hand them out as party gifts, nor did I want to put them on tables and make it seem as if it's some kind of dollar shop, you know, where you just go through, or a flea market type thing. Yeah, I mean, that could have been done, and we probably would have had a lot of other people take complete sets. It would have been easier. They wouldn't have had to strain. But the idea of getting down on your hands and knees, it's almost like, well, there's an aesthetic involved in that that has to do with paying homage to the works and paying homage to the people there. And I understand it was not easy for people, but I think that even if visitors to the gallery didn't do that, they thought about doing it, and they said, I don't think I want to do that. And the folks who did, I think, like yourself, thought it was worthwhile.
Yeah, and say, how was this, or was this connected to Fluxus? You had a friend who was there, one of the artists who had a big T-shirt with the words Fluxus on it. How is it connected to that movement, and how is it connected to maybe a reimagining of that movement, or just using now, you know, the new technology that we have today, the new ideas of kind of the Creative Commons?
The Creative Commons, certainly. Well, there's Facebook, there's Twitter, Blogger we used. Blogger is easily searched. So there was a what I call a social viral art world that was created virtually on the web. People all over the world. I use Flickr. I was a bit of a obsessive, crazy person trying to get as many people interested and energized about this project as possible. So I probably communicated with more than 1,000 people, explained the project endlessly to them, and ask them to submit something or make things by hand if they didn't have the means to do that. Some people found us. I don't know how. A gallery in the Philippines sponsored 8 or 9 or 10 of their artists with cards and sent them in because of the internet. And the social fabric of the internet is something that spreads. It's just viral by its very nature. But in terms of the Fluxus, the re-inspiration of Fluxus in this show, I think there are aspects of it. I've never seen myself as a Fluxus artist. I've done lots of mail art, and that comes from my obsessive letter writing. And then, of course, I met Ray, and I began to understand things in a different way about art, collage, letter writing, the possibilities involved. And I also began to correspond with people who were very deep into mail art. Some use rubber stamps, some use old newspapers, some send objects. As far as Fluxus, I think, you know, I'm not the chairman, and some people, like the chairman being George Matunas. Certainly the scholars, you know, believe that since George Matunas has left us, we really can have Fluxus, but only Fluxus-inspired works. And maybe this is in that way. Many people associated with this project, and I think you're talking about Keith Buchholz or Cecil Touchon, who align themselves with Fluxus-inspired activities, events. I mean, Cecil puts on something called the Fluxibition, and Keith organizes different things, and he's performed with Allison Knowles, who's a Fluxus artist. They love that idea, and they actually performed. Actually, Cecil did a musical piece with rubber bands, and Keith, during the opening, had a small Fluxus-oriented choir, and they sang from a score, and that was quite wonderful. And that was also broadcast live on the internet, which is another way we used the net to communicate with the world. So there was that aspect, but those artists brought that to the show. I think what I do is I created an environment where they could do what they wanted. And, of course, it all worked.
And now you want to inspire other people to use this in however way they want to do that. Talk about some of your vision for the continuation of this show, The Book About Death. And if you've just joined Writer's Voice, I'm talking with Matthew Rose, who is the creative spirit and inspiration behind this unbound book, The Book About Death.
What I thought I was doing all along, and I think we have been successful in it. I say we because it's anyone who participated in this project owns the project, and they can take it out into the world and talk about it. So if someone came into the gallery and collected a full, complete set or even a partial set, what I'm hoping they do and what they have been doing already is propose it to their school or institution or a local museum or a foreign museum and say, hello, I have a complete set of this work that was exhibited in New York. This is the whole blog catalog, and this is these are installation shots on this website. I'm very happy to come to your museum, wherever it is in the world, show the physical collection, and do a projection, you know, using the blog as sort of an image base to project on a wall, and then I can assemble a panel of experts or local artists who can talk about the content or, you know, this kind of art exhibition, kind of what we're talking about now, how that can function today, sort of outside the market. Or, I mean, even within the market, one artist told me that a way of exhibiting the work would be to put the whole thing up on eBay for auction. And I said, go ahead. Just send me the documentation so that the rest of the artists know and everyone else knows what you're doing.
But doesn't that counter the idea of this being non-commercial?
Not really, because we didn't box them up and sell them at the door. I think it's interesting what artists do, and I certainly don't want to be the policeman here. I tried. The only rule I had was you got to send 500 cards to the gallery, and you had to have the phrase in any language, any style, A Book About Death on the card. So I don't want to tell artists what to do or how to reimagine this. If it's eBay, fine. You know, I think that's interesting.
Hmm. Now, you write about art. You've written about art for the New York Times and in other places. And now that you have done this exhibition, what have you taken away from it personally for yourself in terms of the kind of thinking about art that you do and your ideas of things you'd like to do in the future?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because I also started writing a little bit for a Philadelphia-based website called theartblog.org, and that's purely internet. There's no print component to it. And this day and age, with magazines and newspapers, you know, suffering the explosion of this kind of free media, it clearly made me rethink communication-wise, you know, how all these publications, how they have historically reacted to the art world as the art world grew up and became famous and rich, and clearly monies were earned because of it. Now that there's a leveling of that whole playing field, and anybody with a computer can get on there and become an art critic or an art writer or just flash pictures up there, they occupy a similar space as, for instance, the New York Times or the Washington Post or Art News. I mean, they when you're looking at their page, their blog, their thoughts, their photos, it gives them a leg up in some ways. And I'm not quite sure where that's taking us, but it's very interesting. And in the art world, you have people, you know, making things out of Post-its and this kind of temporary, permanent material. And I'm still intrigued by it. I don't know where it's going to go. I'm not even sure exactly how the full thrust of this exhibition will affect me and what I do as an artist. As a, you know, I make collage work and do paint and text and things like that. I'm not quite sure how it's going to affect me, but I think my mind, and certainly the minds of many of the artists who participated in this or even just looked at it and thought about it, I think their imaginations have stirred.
Well, Matthew Rose, thanks so much for joining us here on Writer's Voice. The book is The Book About Death. It is an unbound book of postcards from 500 artists around the world, each one unique and interesting and a comment on the idea of death. Thanks again for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Well, my pleasure. Thank you very much, Francesca.
Matthew Rose creates and writes about art in Paris, France. If you want to see a video of the exhibition, A Book About Death, go to writersvoice.net. We've also got images from the collection and loads of links to more information about it and about the Fluxus movement. Next up, environmental writers Bill McKibben and George Monbiot. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Well, the climate talks in Copenhagen came to an end last week, not with a bang, but a whimper. Some have tried to put a good face on it, but many of those who care about saving the planet from climate catastrophe were sorely disappointed by the non-outcome of the talks in Copenhagen. President Barack Obama announced the climate accord had been reached when he returned to Washington. But Friends of the Earth beg to differ. The environmental organization warned, quote, against the false conclusion that the UN Climate Conference had adopted a Copenhagen Accord. Instead, FOE said, delegates merely noted the agreement's existence, giving it no force whatsoever. The deal itself was greatly watered down from what even the conference leaders understood is necessary to avert runaway climate change. In one of the strangest moments of drama, a memo was leaked from the leaders admitting that all the current targets now on the table would not add up to the 2 degrees that they were publicly saying they would, but to an actual increase in global temperatures of about 3.5 degrees centigrade. That is exactly 3.5 times the temperature increase climate scientist Jim Hansen says is safe. He says even the 2 degrees of warming that was the goal of the Copenhagen talks would put the climate back to where it was 2.5 million years ago, when alligators frolicked at the subtropical North Pole. What was strange about the leak, alas, was not that the leaders had lied to the world, but that environmental writer and activist Bill McKibben's name was scrawled all over the top of the memo. Bill McKibben is the force behind 350.org, a global movement to bring atmospheric carbon dioxide down to 350 parts per million. While he called the talks a sham, he saw reason for hope coming out of Copenhagen, not by looking to the leaders, but to a growing citizens' movement around the world, of which his group is just a part. Writer's Voice spoke with Bill McKibben in 2007 about his book Deep Economy. In it, he says we need to build living local economies that create durability in our economic system for us and for the future. He thinks durability is a better word than sustainability.
We may end up using it always just true because it's sort of what we've hit on, but it's not a very good word. It doesn't really reference anything that has any analog in our own lives. Durability, the word that I've been using, seems to me to imply, maybe it appeals to me because there sort of implies the sort of Yankee virtues of frugality and making do and concentrating as much on whether you can make things last as whether you can make them expand, which may turn out to be just as interesting and difficult to trick. I think it's a powerful idea. I mean, I think you can see it in things like energy. You know, at the moment, we think that it makes great sense to have a highly centralized energy system. But in fact, you know, that energy system depends on being able to persuade the people in southern Appalachia to blow the tops off their mountains to get us cheap coal. And it depends on being able to manipulate the politics of far-off Middle Eastern countries, where we're really, as it turns out, pretty bad at manipulating their politics. A more durable system would be one that worked, I think, sort of more like the Internet, where all kinds of people were putting power in and taking power out. I have solar panels on my roof here in Vermont, and on a nice sunny day like today, we're producing all kinds of power and sending electrons down the line, my electric meter's spinning backwards. Cloud passes over, well, we suck up energy the way other people do, someplace else on the grid. When we get that system fully built out, it'll be more ecologically benign because we'll be able to make more use of renewable sources, but it's also going to be a lot more durable in that sense of the word, a lot sturdier.
Durable in what way? How will that
less,
be more?
Less vulnerable to outside interruption and disruption. The real sources of disruption and worry are, you know, are, as you point out, things like peak oil. They're also, I mean, God, if we took seriously any of our rhetoric about, say, terrorism and the possibility of those kind of disruptions, we should be frightened. I mean, I was in New Orleans yesterday to do some work down there, and it was reminded that, you know, all the natural gas pipelines serving the Northeast, there's three of them, and they, you know, cross within 5 miles of each other as they leave Louisiana headed north. You know, our systems of everything are so centralized and so big that they're extremely vulnerable. And we don't have the communities to cope with those kind of disruptions at the moment, and we need to build them.
Bill McKibben began 350.org soon after that interview. Another writer on climate change is British environmental journalist George Monbiot. We spoke with him in 2007 while earlier climate talks were going on in Bali. He's the author of Heat, How to Stop the Planet from Burning. When I talked with Monbiot in 2007, I had heard even then we need to cut emissions 90% by 2050. I asked him if this target was feasible and if it was even enough.
Well, I'm glad you raised this because the figure's much higher than we think. When you look at the small print in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report, there it is. There's this figure way above the one which we thought was the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And yes, what we now see are calls for a 100% cut in carbon dioxide by 2050, emerging from modelling which shows that that is the only figure which gives a high chance of preventing 2 degrees centigrade of warming. Now, a 100% cut is actually plausible, but it means that you've got to start investing in technologies which strip carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. For instance, these artificial trees, which might be able to turn it into calcium carbonate, into limestone, is beginning to get tricky and very, very expensive. And you know what? I'm absolutely furious because we knew what we had to do 20 years ago. We knew the sort of measures which had to be taken to prevent climate change. And while we had the time, the opportunity to do it, we didn't act primarily because of the very well-organized lobby by the fossil fuel companies to prevent that from taking place, to prevent the necessary action from happening. And if we have lost the battle against climate change, which is a possibility now, I have to admit it is, then it can largely be laid at the door of the professional climate change deniers sponsored by companies like ExxonMobil.
Monbiot says global warming can't be controlled unless government policy makes us change the way we live. Here's what he said about the connection between government and individual behavior.
Well, the first thing to say is that we cannot solve this problem individually. There's a huge wave of green consumerism which tells us you can change the world in your own home and in your own shopping cart. And it's complete nonsense, and it's infuriating nonsense because it's been demonstrably untrue for a very long time. And there are a couple of reasons why it's nonsense. The first is that left to their own devices, people massively exaggerate their own green behavior. They see the things they want to see, and they block out the things they don't want to see. So, for instance, I know people who will say that they're greens, and I say, well, what makes you green? What makes you an environmentalist? And they say, well, we buy environmentally friendly washing up liquid, and I'm wearing organic cotton underpants, and a few things like this. And you say, but wait a minute, you've got a holiday home in Cape Town, and you fly there six times a year. That outweighs by 100,000 times the things that you are talking about. But of course, they've blotted that out. They don't want to see it. The second reason why it doesn't work is that even if you were to reduce your own carbon emissions to zero, that has no wider effect in the rest of society. In fact, you can simply create ecological space which other people then occupy. I'll give you an example. You can get rid of your car, and of course that's a good thing to do environmentally, but if there's no government policy to reduce the road space allocated to cars, all you do is to create space on the roads and create parking space for a car less efficient than the one that you would have chosen, for somebody else to own and drive that car. And it's simply impossible to produce a sustained program of carbon cuts through individual action. We have to have governments coming in and saying we're going to cap the amount of carbon dioxide that an economy can produce, and we're going to allocate that carbon fairly amongst everyone in the country. And that's a way of describing what is known now as carbon rationing, which seems to me to be the only fair way of dealing with this problem.
And yet, in talking about regulation, you also say that regulation actually enhances human freedom.
But bizarrely, yes. I mean, we've always been told, thanks to this extraordinary onslaught in the media by the neoliberals who control most of the big media organizations. I mean, these are big business people who've got a very simple aim in life. They want a better world for people like themselves. And if you are a billionaire, you want a better world for billionaires. There's no mystery about why people who by definition are extremely rich, because you have to be to own a major media organization, about why they want a particular kind of politics. They want a particular kind of politics because it favors their interests. And their interest is in minimal regulation, is in getting government off their backs, into stopping government from governing. And of course that suits them very well, because that allows them to trample all over everybody else. But regulation of the right kind is the only thing which guarantees human freedom, because it's the only thing which guarantees us freedom from oppression and destruction and murder and all the other social ills which we all recognize. And in fact, if there weren't a regulatory state of any kind, then we would go back to the kind of gangster capitalism which you can see in West Africa today, or you could see in Russia immediately after the revolution there, which brought down communism. We have to have a state which sets the boundaries for individual action in order to protect people from other people. And generally that means to protect people from those who are more powerful than themselves. Now, I was talking in my book about a very specific case, which is the fact that there is no proper regulation governing the way that houses are renovated in my country, the United Kingdom. And so the government can't say to a builder, you have to make this house more energy efficient when you renovate it, otherwise you could be penalized through our regulations. Now, people say, well, we don't want to have that sort of bureaucracy, that sort of regulation, that makes us less free. But because that doesn't exist, in the house I was living in at the time of writing that book, me and my wife were virtually freezing to death because it had been so badly renovated that all the heat just poured straight out through the windows and through the roof and through the walls. And by constraining one person to do the job properly, then the next four or five owners of that house are going to have a comfortable place to live. We're freed from the burden of being extremely cold and having to pay a fortune on heating bills. So you can see that even on that micro level, regulation actually creates human comfort and human freedom.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with George Monbiot about his book Heat, How to Stop the Planet from Burning. You talk about rationing, and rationing is something I think in the American mind that says is a big bugaboo, in spite of the fact that, you know, we had no trouble doing it during World War II, but I think there's a very different kind of mentality today. Talk first about contraction and convergence as a way into that. This was an idea that, ironically enough, was invented by a musician. What is it? What's a contraction? What's a convergence? And how does this connect to rationing?
Sure. Well, let me just say to begin with that the man who invented it, Aubrey Mayer, is one of those extraordinary characters who is completely outside the field of expertise, but just has this brilliant idea. And sometimes you need to step back a little bit in order to have a brilliant idea. If you're too immersed in the details, you can't see the big picture. And the brilliant idea is this. He says there's only one fair way to resolve this problem, and that is to end up with everybody on Earth having an equal entitlement to produce this pollutant, carbon dioxide, because anything else is unfair to the poorest nations who haven't been able to go through a development phase. And so he's saying what we need to see is we need to set the sustainable level for carbon dioxide emissions, which I'm afraid the science shows us is lower every year than we thought it would be, but we find out what that sustainable level is, and we set the date by which that level must be reached, again wholly informed by the science. And then we find out the trajectory from that level and from that date, from where we are to there. And some countries might be able to raise their emissions to get to that point because they produce so little carbon dioxide as it is. In Ethiopia, for example, the people there produce 1/600th of the carbon dioxide that we do in the United Kingdom. But other countries, especially the rich countries, are going to have to bring theirs right down. But they eventually all end up at the same point. That's a critical thing. That's the contraction bit and the convergence bit. And so having then decided what that point is and having allocated national emissions according to that point and according to every year that you're moving towards that point, you can then divide them up between the people of the nation. They're allocated according to the national population so that everybody on Earth gets an equal entitlement. And you say, well, about 40% of those emissions are produced directly by us. When, for instance, we buy gas to put in our cars, when we buy heating and electricity for our homes, then we're directly responsible for the burning of those fossil fuels. The other 60% are burnt on our behalf by corporations and by government. So you say, right, that 60%, we'll auction that off to the corporations. We'll set a cap for the economy, the amount we have, and the scarcity of the carbon dioxide sets the price, and they have to buy it on the open market. And, of course, the more intense their competition for it, the higher the price goes, and so they have a very powerful incentive to invest in energy efficiency. The 40%, the carbon dioxide that we produce directly, we get given free of charge. Each one of us, each citizen of the state, is given the same allocation, the same ration of carbon dioxide. And you can use it up however you wish. You can burn the whole lot in one flight in a private jet if you want, but then you'd have to buy surplus emissions from somebody else in order to keep your lights on and to keep your house warm. Well, there's several really good features about this. One, it's very simple, so everybody can understand straight away what it's about. It's a carbon ration, you'll get the same amount, and if you use more, you have to buy some from somebody else who uses less. Number two, the poor on the whole use less than the rich, and so you'll see a transfer here of money going from the rich to the poor. So it's a progressive measure. Number three, is that it has an inbuilt incentive to cut your emissions as much as possible and to invest in energy-efficient technology. So, for instance, you say, well, I want to have the lights on in my house, but I don't want to use up all my carbon ration. Therefore, I better buy some energy-efficient light bulbs, and I better buy my electricity from a company which is producing it from renewable means. And so you straight away have an incentive to buy into these new technologies, and you give them a great big stimulus.
Well, my question on that is, you talk about rich countries and poor countries, and I certainly understand the fairness there. But, you know, within rich countries, there are vastly different incomes, particularly in the United States. You know, the poor, for example, generally own gas-guzzling cars and can't afford to buy a Prius. Yes. How do you make a system of rationing more fair within the rich countries?
Yes, you're absolutely right to point that out. And here in the United Kingdom, poor people generally live in not very efficient houses. Even so, despite taking all that into account, by and large, the poor use less energy than the rich because your energy use is very closely tied to your level of income. On the whole, people use as much energy as their income allows. But you're absolutely right to raise this point. So there has, at the same time, to be a government program to help the poor to minimize their energy use. And that means helping people to insulate their homes, having grants for insulation, helping people to trade up to a more energy-efficient car, and again, you could see a grant scheme, or indeed laying on much more efficient and effective and inexpensive public transport for poorer people to use. So you can't just create the rationing system and then leave it to the market. Rationing by itself isn't going to solve the problem, but it's the necessary step. It's not the sufficient step. And you've got to add to the rationing several other government policies which then make it even fairer, but also accelerate the process towards cutting carbon emissions.
We're talking with George Monbiot about his book Heat, How to Stop the Planet from Burning. Monbiot ends his book Heat talking about love. He talks on the one hand about love miles, the distance we travel to be with the ones we love, and the carbon footprint that leaves on the atmosphere. Yet he ends the book with mention of his then infant daughter, who was born just as he was finishing the book.
Well, I pointed out in the book the paradox that you can be a good person by every single measure that we've ever given ourselves in the past, and still be responsible for the greatest problem that humanity now faces. You can be responsible for killing people. And the more carbon dioxide you produce, the more people you're likely to be killing as a result, even though you do it with the best possible intentions. And what I point out is that climate change demands a new morality. It demands a new moral compass which goes beyond the morality that we're used to. And a good example of this is what I call love miles. And love miles is the distance between you and somebody else that you love. And many people are driven to fly and to travel very long distances because of their love miles. And it is morally wrong for them not to do so, according to the old morality. The old morality says you have to fly to your sister's wedding if she's getting married in Sydney or Cape Town or Beijing or somewhere, you have to go. How could you not go? It's immoral not to go, and that's true. It is immoral not to go, but it's also now immoral to go. Climate change says it is immoral to travel, just as it is also moral to travel. And this is, you know, very confusing because we've got a whole different set of morality imposed upon the old morals, and we've just got to pay attention to both of them and somehow to resolve these incredibly difficult dilemmas. And what I point out in this is that the planet can be destroyed by love. It's quite easy to see how this enormous problem of love miles is creating a situation in which people are killed and the biosphere, which sustains human beings, is destroyed through us trying to do the right thing. And there's this tremendous irony, this tremendous paradox here, which I wanted to highlight. But then when my daughter was born, a couple of weeks before I finished the book, slightly ahead of schedule, she was 1 week ahead of schedule, I was 1 week behind schedule, and it was made for a rather difficult last couple of chapters, I was struck by a couple of things, really. First of all, that that it had never really hit home to me quite what I was dealing with up to that point. I'd written this book where I had investigated the science, I'd investigated the solutions, I'd gone into great detail in doing my research into the facts and the figures, and I'd seen vast columns of data, and I'd read, I don't know, 20, 30,000 pages of material in order to try to understand what was necessary. And it had become quite abstract. It had become quite theoretical. This was this weird thing called climate change happening to this weird place called planet Earth, and we needed all these weird solutions to try to deal with it. And it became almost a board game or a computer game to trying to work out how to solve problem A with solutions B. And it didn't really hit home to me quite what it was that I was dealing with, that I was talking about 6 billion human beings here, and 6 billion human beings who included you and me and everybody I'd ever met. And then suddenly this strange little creature, this daughter of mine, was born. And you know what newborn babies are like. They're still part of the ecosystem, really. They're not quite human. They're part frog. They're part small furry animal. They're part alien being, part fairy, part pixie. They're a strange little creature, groping around, half blind in this new world, and not knowing what to make of it. And they don't quite belong yet to the human race. They still belong to some extent to the ecosystem. And here I was faced with this extraordinary little person sitting on my thigh as I was writing the last two chapters, and I was looking at her and I was looking at what I was writing, and suddenly it hit me with the force of a hurricane that this is what I was dealing with, and that this is what I've been writing about times 6 billion. And I realized then that this wasn't an academic exercise, that this was life and death, and life and death over a vast and staggering scale, which I could scarcely get my mind around, but also life and death on a very, very small scale, and that small scale was sitting on my thigh.
George Monbiot writes regularly for the UK newspaper The Guardian. In 1995, Nelson Mandela presented him with a UN Global 500 Award for Outstanding Environmental Achievement. We just have time for a poem by nature poet Wally Swist. It's called Sharp-Shinned Hawk. An explosion of cardinals, juncos, and black-capped chickadees out of the nimbus of the sugar maple's crown leaves the branches in one electric instant, clattering. The sharp-shinned hawk zeroes in to settle on its target perch. Its talons curl to grip the bark. It rides up and down. The dark flight feathers and the underwhite of its tail suggest an arrow quivering in its mark. The disappointment of the hunt reveals itself in the unnerving, slight twitches of tail feathers, the slow rotation of its head from side to side. Then it stretches out of its fierce, hunched posture, flies up, veering out of the maple, off on a sharp angle toward the back pasture. Just when it begins to rise in the wind, it disappears through the deception of exquisite bones. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net for more about today's shows. You'll find links to more information, web-only features, and you can sign up for our podcast and get connected on Twitter and Facebook. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.